Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun, Dan Rogics here, Sun columnist. And this is Roughly Speaking, episode 381. It's Wednesday, April 25th, 2018. One of the most shocking and depressing developments in Baltimore, where shocking and depressing have had a long partnership, was the Gun Trace Task Force scandal. Cops behaving as pirates, basically robbing suspects, conducting illegal raids. It was one of the biggest police corruption cases in the city's history, and it hit federal court at a time when Baltimore was still recovering from the problems wrought by the Freddie Gray case in 2015. In a city beset with a long surge of violent crime, trust between citizens and police is vital. And the Gun Trace Task Force scandal was a setback in the effort to restore that trust. A candidate for state's attorney has made this an issue in his campaign to unseat the city's incumbent chief prosecutor, Marilyn Mosby. The candidate, Thiru Vignaraja, says Mosby has not done enough to address police corruption, starting with the collateral damage from the Gun Trace Task Force. Vignaraja claims that Mosby's office does not even know how many criminal cases have been tainted by the corruption convictions of the eight officers assigned to the gun unit. Vignaraja has a number. He says it's more than 2,300 cases from 2010 to mid-2017, and he has a plan for reviewing each case to determine if it should be thrown out. He goes further than that, pledging to develop a system to detect police corruption and investigate it. He also claims that Mosby, who gained national stardom by bringing charges against the Freddie Gray Six, has missed opportunities to bring charges in nearly 30 of the police-involved shootings during her tenure. Thiru Vignaraja is a Democrat challenging Mosby in the June primary. This is his second visit to Roughly Speaking. Another candidate, Ivan Bates, has been my guest once so far, and Marilyn Mosby has been invited to sit here for an interview as well. Now to Thiru Vignaraja, a former prosecutor and deputy attorney general of Maryland, who says he's developed a comprehensive list of more than 2,300 cases that might be jeopardized because the police officers involved were members of the corrupt Gun Trace Task Force.
So there have now been, going back to 2010, 2,322 circuit court criminal cases that involved one of the eight convicted officers that came out of that federal corruption trial.
And how did you get to that number?
Yeah, I mean, this was an important exercise. One of the frustrations for me, both as a candidate and as a citizen, is I would hear the current state's attorney and others give different numbers about how broad the impact of this federal corruption trial was. We knew that these eight officers had been engaging in some of the worst corruption this city, perhaps the nation, had ever seen, but we didn't know what the fallout would be. Sometimes I'd hear that 800 or so cases would be affected. At the end of the year, Ms. Mosby issued a report that said 300 cases were impacted.
It was the low hundreds, as I recall.
That's right.
That's why this number jumped out at me.
Then she gave a panel interview up in New York a couple months ago, and she said potentially thousands of cases. And part of my reaction, I went to my team and I said, how do you not know a year after the indictments what the impact of this is? And so I asked my team, I said, let's get together and figure this out ourselves. This is public information. So we started pulling an index of every case that involved one of the eight convicted officers. I don't know if you remember, Dan, about a month and a half ago, there was a question about the Maryland judiciary's decision, error as it turned out, to withdraw certain information from case search. They'd taken officers' names down.
Right.
And we immediately jumped into that and said, we're going to publish it ourselves, the names of these officers. One of the reasons we were able so quickly to do that was because we were already working on putting this index together. And in the course of a few weeks, we were able to catalog. It's the first public index of the 2,322 cases where one of these eight officers was listed as a subpoenaed witness.
Does that mean they should all be dismissed?
Certainly not. But I think one of the things the public needs is a clear roadmap of how you should approach these cases. Every few months, you hear some cases got dropped. And respectfully, I think sometimes the state's attorney's office uses this case as a reason, whether it was true or not, that these cases were being dropped. What I would propose to do is to actually outline for the public a clear framework for how you approach these cases. Some of these cases involve one of the 8 convicted officers, and the officer was an indispensable part of that case. That case has to be dropped if it's pending. If it resulted in a conviction, we ought to join a motion to reopen.
How do you do that evaluation? Indispensable. How do you come up with that?
Yeah, I mean, the legal test would be, could you get over a motion to dismiss the case if the witness was not available? Would you have enough evidence to even get to a jury? That's the legal test. But this is not a hard one. If only one officer saw the gun or saw the drugs, nobody else saw it, and that officer is one of the 8 convicted officers, that officer's credibility is in real trouble, to put it politely. That case can't go forward. And if that was one of the convictions, we ought to reopen the case and think about it, because if we had known this back then, we would have had to dismiss it. So it's not fair that a conviction was obtained without that knowledge out there. That's a relatively easy category. There's another category, which is an officer who is implicated by the testimony. You know, some of these officers, not the 8, were mentioned in testimony during the federal trial, but they were never charged. They were certainly never convicted. And those officers may have played a really tertiary role, you know, a secondary role. Those are cases where we ought to presumptively go forward. We ought to go forward with close supervision. We don't necessarily need to drop that case or revisit that case. And then the other two categories, the categories where they're an essential witness, but they're not critical to the case, or a non-essential witness, those cases we just have to do a case-by-case review. And I don't mean to simplify it. I just want to make sure the public understands that there's a method to how we go about doing it.
How do you know Marilyn Mosby's office isn't doing this?
I think there's 2 telltale signs. One of them is, quite literally, even a year later, we don't have an index of the cases that they're even looking at. I think the first step is saying, listen, there's 2,322 cases to review. Here's how we're going to review it. The second piece of it is certainly possible that there is a method to how they're doing it. But the public needs to know what that method is, because right now, the corruption's victims are not just the defendants that were hurt by them. It's the faith in the system. And if we're going to renew that faith, if we're going to rebuild trust, the public needs to know that there's a reasonable, sound, thoughtful way to redress the wrong that has been committed.
When you reflect on the Gun Trace Task Force case and everything that's happened in federal court and, as a result, in state court, what signs were there that some of this could have been avoided? One of your opponents in the primary, Ivan Bates, says that there were warning signs.
Yeah. You know, I think it's really important not just to complain about the mess, but to clean it up. And I think the first part of that is addressing these 2,300 cases. Right. But you're absolutely right. The next part of the conversation has to be, what could we have seen earlier on to make sure this doesn't happen? I've heard the accusation that Ms. Mosby knew about this and was complicit in it. I don't know that that's fair. I think what is fair is to say that she should have known about it and that there were some warning signs that anybody who's paying attention would have seen. I've talked about 2 in the past. One of them is the spike in overtime that happened in 2015 and 2016.
Now, how would a state's attorney know about that?
Well, it's public information. I mean, when we put our report on this out there, it was from public source information that we gathered it.
But if you're a state's attorney, mm-hmm. how concerned are you with police overtime? That seems like something that's the business of the police department.
You know, I think if you run on the platform that part of your job is to clean up police misconduct and police corruption, this ought to be something you're looking at. This was not some, you know, an overtime slip here, an overtime slip there. This is $1.3 million in overtime collected by just these 8 officers. A majority of that happened in 2015 and 2016. There was a sudden spike for these 8 officers. They started collecting $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 in overtime each. That should have caught somebody's attention.
Did that include time in court?
It included time in court. It included time on the streets. To be clear, we don't know what the breakdown is, because the numbers that are publicly reported are aggregate numbers. They're total numbers. But those are numbers, if you're looking hard, that you can pinpoint and focus on. The state's attorney's office actually signs off on a lot of this overtime for the court overtime. And so you have actually an immediate piece of visibility into this issue.
Well, that's significant. So an officer shows up in court, the entity that signs off on that is the state's attorney?
That has been traditionally what has happened. It's certainly what happened when we were there. We would sort of initial a set of overtime slips that says, I asked for this person to be here because he may or she may be called to the stand, and she was here all day because I wanted to be sure that if we had an opportunity to call her, she was available for court. either Ms. Mosby and the state's attorney's office has surrendered that responsibility, in which case they've given up an opportunity to make sure we're monitoring this, or they've kept it and they were looking not carefully enough at this really conspicuous red flag.
So that's one thing that could be part of an early warning system. What else?
You know, the other one is the number of cases on which these officers suddenly started congregating. You know, in the early years, the federal indictment has allegations and ultimately convictions that date back to conduct in the late 2008, 2009, 2010. But in 2015 and 2016, where a lot of this happened, these eight officers started coming together on cases like they'd never seen before. You know, they were typically one or two officers were on a particular case. But if you look at these 2,322 cases, in the very last 2 years, four, five, six officers end up showing up on a case. That's unusual. They'd been working together before, but all of a sudden, and I think the looking back, we see this, they were coming together to commit these crimes, and each time they got together, they were. So what we should be doing is to make sure that we develop early warning systems like this. This is not even the sophisticated stuff. You know, I want to create a civil rights division that is really thinking hard about what kinds of patterns we should be focusing on. Is there a certain kind of statement of probable cause to get into a house that is being used over and over again by a police officer? Because if every time it's a confidential informant that's telling them, maybe we should take a closer look. It may be absolutely valid. The analogy that I sometimes use is a suspicious activity report at a bank. You withdraw $10,000 at a time. That sets out a red flag. You go take a closer look. There may be a completely legitimate reason for it, but sometimes there's not. And in this case, they could have seen it.
So if you have a civil rights division in the state's attorney's office, if an assistant state's attorney is suspicious about something, they would turn that over to the civil rights office?
That's exactly right. And it's modeled on the federal civil rights division. You know, when I became chief of major investigations in Baltimore City, part of the goal was to take the strategies and approaches that federal prosecutors had been using with RICO prosecutions and gang prosecutions and to really bring that to the city state's attorney's office. I want to do the same thing when it comes to police accountability. One of the silver linings of this federal corruption case was we saw police and prosecutors, local law enforcement, federal agencies working together to bring police to account. It was a hard case. It was a long investigation. But we showed in a courtroom that they can be brought to justice. It just requires a really strong, robust investigation.
So if you have a suspicion of wrongdoing by a police officer, you would conduct an investigation? The police department would?
So we would work with law enforcement, whether it's the state police or local law enforcement. The federal agencies work with their federal law enforcement partners even when they're investigating federal corruption. They do the same thing in the case of local law enforcement. Baltimore police officers worked on this federal corruption trial that was targeting Baltimore police officers. That's not where the conflict is. What you need to do, though, is have a team of people that are committed to bringing police officers that are engaging in this corruption to justice and then giving them the tools and the training and the opportunity to do their job.
There was another number from your report that jumped out at me. It was 30, I believe. 30 police-involved shootings during Marilyn Mosby's tenure as state's attorney. Yeah. Now, we know that she brought the case against the Freddie Gray Six. No convictions there. Ended up dropping the remaining charges. What about these other cases?
Yeah,
what's happened to those cases?
Yeah, this is another aspect of police accountability that I think is really important. The public has a sense of whether to trust police, in part because of these high-profile police-involved shootings. There have been 30 of them since 2015. 12 of them were fatal. Ms. Mosby has not brought charges in a single one. Now, I don't want to second-guess any particular judgment, but there is a pattern that people need to be aware of. And what I'm afraid of is that because Ms. Mosby brought charges in the Freddie Gray case, she's got the perception that she's tough on police when nothing could be further from the truth. The few cases that have resulted in a conviction at trial, in one of them was a police officer, Officer Cagle, who stood atop a suspect and shot him in the groin and then cursed at him afterwards.
This was after two other officers had subdued him or wounded him, I think.
That's right.
In a grocery store.
That's exactly right. They were not able to secure a conviction on attempted murder, which is hard to explain, but they then got a conviction on the assault. And the prosecutor from Ms. Mosey's office went in and recommended a sentence that was below what the judge gave. The judge said, even your recommendation isn't serious enough. And so I think there is this perception that Ms. Mosby is holding police accountable and bringing them to justice when there's no evidence of that. And so I flagged the 30 cases because I think people need to know that these cases are also not being taken as seriously as I would. Part of that is back to the Civil Rights Division. It's training.
Well, how do you know they're not being taken seriously? Because she didn't bring charges?
Well,
in a single one? I mean, you're saying based on that pattern, she's not taking this seriously. She doesn't want to prosecute cops.
It's a fair question. It's not just the outcomes. It's the process. The national expectation on police-involved shootings is that there ought to be a preliminary assessment of what happened within 60 days. And we have published an index of all the cases that have been done, including two cases that she had handed over to other jurisdictions. And in both of those jurisdictions, one was handled by Anne Arundel County, another one was handled, I believe, by Baltimore County, the investigation was concluded within 60 days. On average, Ms. Mosby has taken 9 months to come to a conclusion. And that's a problem for a different reason, which is that the administrative investigation into whether or not these police officers handled this properly or not is delayed. There's a longstanding understanding at the request of the state's attorney that police don't start their internal investigation until the criminal investigation is over. I don't know if you remember, Dan, the legislature has debated sometimes how quickly a police officer ought to give a statement. And there's a big debate whether it should be 10 days or 5 days.
Right.
Well, that clock doesn't start running until the criminal investigation's over. So none of those officers are giving statements to explain what happened until at least 9 months on average after the incident. And at that point, the police officers understand are saying, I don't really remember the details. I don't remember. That also means that these cases aren't being taken seriously because you're undermining the ability of the police department to do their investigation. So one of the things that I want to do, this has been done on the West Coast in some cities, is to authorize parallel investigations, to allow the administrative investigation to go forward, even as my criminal investigation goes forward. Sometimes it's going to take more than 60 days. It ought to be the exception, not the norm.
What would explain that 9 months? You're saying that's on average, because I'll contact the state's attorney and find out what the deal is there. But what would explain it? Do they lack investigators?
Yeah. I'm sure part of their explanation is that they're looking really hard and really closely at the case. I think part of the investigation is that the office is in disarray. They're understaffed in a lot of sections. There's a lot of new prosecutors that have never done this stuff before. And it takes time to learn how to do these cases if you're learning on the job. And again, on any given case, it might be appropriate for take 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. But if that is your norm, that's a problem.
Speaking of inexperienced prosecutors, that's one of the things you talked about the first time you visited the show, the turnover in the office that took place after Marilyn Mosby assumed the office in 2015, January. So what would you do about that? There must be a lot of inexperienced prosecutors that you'd be inheriting.
Yeah. You know, building a world-class office is really important to being able to do our job, whether it comes to cutting murders in half in 3 years, which is what we talked about last time, or holding police accountable. I think there's a couple of aspects of that. One of them is we need to put in place a world-class training program so the people that are inexperienced get experience and get it quick. But we also need to make sure that people come to this office knowing that this is the gold standard in the country. I think I mentioned to you before that the New York DA's office was considered for years.
Manhattan.
That's right. The Manhattan DA's office was considered the best prosecutor's office in the country. Robert Morgenthau, the legendary DA there, over the course of a 40-year career, attracted people from all across the country. And his pitch was simple. I think I may have mentioned this to you before. He said, come work for me, 100 hours a week, a dime on the dollar. Get in at 7, stay until midnight and work weekends, but work on the most important cases in America. This is a job that ought to sell itself. This is a job where people ought to be clamoring to come and work in Baltimore City. And the truth is, New York City hasn't got them anymore. Baltimore is. And we ought to use the crisis that we are facing as a lightning rod to get people that are dedicated to this stuff to come to Baltimore and help solve it. There are plenty of good prosecutors and plenty of potential in that office, but it requires training, it requires motivation, it requires organization, it requires leadership. And that has been woefully missing these last couple of years.
I wanted to ask you if you had encountered any police officers during the campaign, either on or off duty, and talked to them about what's going on in the city in terms of just their attitude towards serving the public these days. You know, there's a lot of people who think there's been a lingering blue flu. What do you pick up from any cops that you talk to?
Yeah. You know, they're understandably frustrated, and some of their frustration is fair and some of their frustration is unfair. They have a tough job to do, but they should understand going into the job that it's a tough job. I think part of their frustration is it's not just that crime is high, it's that the partnership with prosecutors has never been worse. That ought to be a collaborative relationship built on mutual trust. That doesn't mean we're always going to agree. It oftentimes means we have to agree to disagree, but there ought to be a conversation about it. I think they're also frustrated at the fact that trust in police is at an all-time low. And part of why I want to talk about restoring faith in law enforcement is that's an indispensable part of what we have to do. But you just don't do it by saying we're going to restore faith. You got to create a civil rights division to make sure that police are being held accountable when that's appropriate. That civil rights division also has to engage in trainings. You know, one of the most frustrating stories over the last 6 months was a bunch of police officers that were being passed and put on the streets, even though they'd failed basic tests on constitutional policing. That was troubling itself. What was even more troubling was that the state's attorney's response was no comment. That's ridiculous. The state's attorney is the one that's supposed to be helping explain and train police officers on what's legal, what's not, what's constitutional, what's not. I'm going to assign a full-time prosecutor to the training division of the police department. They're going to help train cadets. They're going to help train veteran officers on developments in the law. That's how I think you restore faith. You don't do it by hoping against hope. You do it by putting in place policies and plans to get it done. That is not going to be done overnight, but it can be done in the course of a generation. It has to start now.
So if you have a case that's dismissed because of constitutional violations, right?
Yeah.
Fourth, Fifth Amendment conflicts, what would the Civil Rights Division do?
They would take a close look at it to make sure there were no civil rights violations, which themselves would be the subject of a prosecution. But assuming there weren't, there's still a lot to learn from that case. Sometimes the officer is making a violation because he doesn't have or she doesn't have a clear enough understanding of the law. Mm. So we're going to take those and create anecdotes and examples that we then turn around and train. It's what we do with prosecutors. When we lost a trial, we used to watch the tape, find out where some errors were, and we didn't beat them up about it, but we did say, listen, here's some opportunities for improvement. That's not happening. And prosecutors are in such a good position to do that because they know that the error cost them the case. They know that the error made the case less triable.
Is there time for all of this? We always hear how overworked all assistant state's attorneys are and the dockets are so big and busy. Is there time for all of this? Because you're making reference to the time when you were a federal prosecutor, right?
I'm making a reference to when I was a federal prosecutor and when I was a city prosecutor. The truth is, I was a supervisor in the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office. If a prosecutor in my unit lost a trial, I said, good work, good effort. Now let's go take a look at the tape. Watch your opening, watch your closing, watch the direct examination, cross-examination of the main witness, and see if there was room for improvement. We have to make time for that, because if there was an error on one of those trials, that's an error that's going to be repeated over and over again unless we diagnose it and unless we correct it. There's a lot of work to be done. No mistake about that. And if anybody needs to be reminded of the sense of urgency, I'm a demanding boss. I'm going to make sure that people are clear about what the stakes are. But it also means making sure that we're not prosecuting thousands of petty offenses involving victims of addiction. We've talked about this before. Part of my solution is to make sure we do have the time to focus on the carjackings and the corruption, to focus on the shootings and the misconduct. I don't know that the public would ever be satisfied by saying there's not enough time to do our jobs right. That's an unacceptable answer. No disrespect, Dan.
That's fine. Speaking of time, the primary is June 26th. There are no debates scheduled yet among the Democratic candidates.
That's very frustrating. I have made it very clear that we will go to any debate, no matter who else shows up. I've gone to a couple of debates and forums where there's two empty chairs. I'm tired of debating empty chairs. I've invited the other candidates to a forum at Riverside Park at the Pavilion, which was scheduled at the same time as a debate that got canceled because Ms. Mosby didn't accept, and Mr. Bates canceled, saying he wouldn't be there unless Ms. Mosby was. People want to hear about ideas. I know that's a good political gimmick, but people want to hear about these solutions, and I hope the other candidates will understand the importance of these debates. The last two candidates who decided that they didn't need to debate didn't do well on election day. So for the sake of democracy, but also for the sake of their campaigns, I hope they show up. I'll be there every time.
Very- Theroux. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Theroux Vignaraja is a Democratic candidate for Baltimore State's attorney. The primary election is June 26th. The Baltimore Sun is arranging to have a debate of state's attorney's candidates in early June. We're doing that in collaboration with WJZ-TV and the University of Baltimore. I asked the state's attorney's office for comment on what Theroux Vignaraja had to say in his plan for restoring trust in Baltimore police. To the question of his number, 2,322 cases involving members of the Gun Trace Task Force, the state's attorney's office said the following, quote, "Based upon the subsequent trial testimony of the GTTF officers, which implicated criminality conducted within a more expansive time period, and even alleged the involvement of additional officers, our office must now employ even greater resources to assess potentially thousands of cases. This is an extremely arduous process that we are still assessing." As for Vignaraja's reference to 30 police-involved shootings, the long investigations, and the lack of prosecution, the state's attorney's office responded this way, quote, "There have been 8 police-involved fatal shootings that our office declined to charge, which the rationale and basis for our decisions are published on our website. 2 additional fatal incidents were referred to other jurisdictions for investigation due to potential conflicts of interest, and following the investigations, those jurisdictions declined to prosecute the officers involved in those shootings as well. Finally, there are 2 police-involved shootings that are currently under review," end quote. After getting that response, I went back to Vignaraja, who referred me to a chart on his website showing the police-involved shootings, the length of time it took to investigate them, and the outcomes of those investigations. There is also a map you can click on to get details of each incident. You can get a link to that in the notes for this episode of Roughly Speaking at BaltimoreSun.com. That's our show for today. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please tell your friends about the podcast. If you get a chance, review our show on iTunes. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy welcomes David Linden, Johns Hopkins Professor of Neuroscience and editor of Think Tank, a cutting-edge collection of essays exploring the quirky and counterintuitive aspects of the brain. Wednesday, April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop at 6080 Falls Road. For more information, call 410-377-2966 or go to theivybookshop.com.